The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And can you hear okay, the outer hall? So, today I'd like to talk about a very important aspect of mindfulness practice, Buddhist practice as a whole, or Buddhism as a whole, and that is the topic of an investigation. And in presenting this idea of investigation, there's one thing I would like you to learn today. You can learn a lot of things, but hopefully. I'd like to teach you a Pali word, an ancient Buddhist word. And the word is ehipasiko, ehipasiko. And it means, it's often translated into English as come and see. And it's a description, there's a number of attributes of Dharma. And the Dharma, one of the attributes of the Dharma is said to, invites inspection. Come and see, it's often translated as come and see. Ehipasiko. And Buddhist monks, nuns, will chant the praises of the attributes of the Dharma every day, and every day they'll say it's ehipasiko. And I've heard of Buddhist teachers who light up like a light bulb with the idea that, yes, come and take a closer look. So this idea of investigation, of inquiry, of looking, is one of the hallmarks of Buddhism, and you're invited to come and look. It's said sometimes that everything you need to learn about Buddhism can be discovered through your powers of observation. You don't have to necessarily read a book to understand what Buddhism is. In fact, perhaps you can't really understand Buddhism by reading a book. It has to be done somehow with inquiring into yourself, into your own experience in a direct way. Investigation is closely connected to mindfulness because one of the ways to deepen mindfulness or enhance it or grow it is to bring in this quality of investigation, to look more closely at our experience, to look more closely at this life of ours. And it makes a big difference to investigate. And one of the ways, of course, is we can see more deeply what's going on, more clearly. The other is that investigation changes the ecosystem that we're in. So they say that, you know, that if you introduce a new species to an ecosystem, the whole ecosystem shifts and changes accordingly. And if you bring in a new species into your mind, then your mental ecosystem has to change. And if your ecosystem is primarily made up of preoccupation, attachment, fear, being caught in things, then investigation is a new species. Some people don't investigate very much. They're not curious. They don't look into things. And as you look in more carefully, it tends to, it can often break up the fixed viewpoints, the fixed attachments that we have, and brings in a different perspective. It opens up the perspective. If nothing else, if the investigation gets strong, it's like stepping out of the glue. It's like stepping out of the fray and being above it, or stepping back and seeing at the bird's eye view, what's going on here? With the idea, hopefully the confidence that that's worthwhile to do. It's worthwhile, it's meaningful to investigate. Even if you don't get an answer to your investigation, you don't discover something, the very act of investigation itself is a place of refuge, it's a place of support, it's a place to be where our confidence can reside. And if you tap into that kind of confident investigation, the mental ecosystem changes. And that changes the whole thing in some ways, can make a huge difference, can loosen up places we're caught and attached or things we're stuck in. So the word in Pali, in ancient language, for investigation is Dhamma Vichaya. Vichaya means kind of investigate, and Dhamma means Dharma. So investigate the Dharma. And there can be many different things, and you find different Buddhist teachers and traditions will define Dhamma Vicaya, this investigation of dharmas, in different ways. The tendency is you define it according to what your definition of the dharma is, what you think the dharma is, or what you think the practice is. That's what investigation, you know. There's different schools of mindfulness, and they have different ways in which they want you to be mindful of, different things to be mindful of. And so when they define investigation, they define it according to their school's interest. It's all beautiful, but it's just you find different interpretations or ideas of what it means. One idea of investigation is to investigate the Dharma, meaning the Buddhist teachings themselves. And it can be helpful, especially if you're new to all this, to do some reading, to do some studying, see what the Buddha said. For some people, it's a rather foreign concept, foreign idea. Even though it's foreign, for some people it's enlightening right away. It's very meaningful right away to get a whole different perspective on the life that is different from the perspective they had before. So, for example, a very common perspective we have is to see our experience, see ourselves through the filter of ourselves, through the self, through self-identity, the idea of being autonomous, the idea of being a personal life, an inner life, my life. All can seem very innocent and very appropriate. And if you study the Dharma, you find out the Buddha said that there are other ways of understanding your experience that may be more beneficial than you than from the point of view of your, of me, myself, and mine, from the self-identity, from your identity, I am this person. You don't want to ignore your experience, but you can see it through a different lens. And one of the different lenses is to see it, to investigate, to look into your experience through the perspective of what's called the Four Noble Truths. To look at where you feel stress, where you feel tension, where you feel uneasy, where you feel suffering, and where you feel, what that stress or tension comes from in yourself. The clinging, the grasping, the craving, the drivenness, the compulsion that seems to give birth to that stress or that tension. And then to investigate, is it possible to find a way to release, relax that craving, that compulsion, become free of it. So that's a radical different way of looking at our experience, because one of them has, what is in it for me? What am I supposed to do? Who am I in this situation? What do I have to prove myself? Who am I supposed to be? Where am I going? Where have I been in the past? There's a strong tendency to look through things through the point of view of I. If you put aside all the ideas of a person and look directly at the medical model is at the illness, the cause of the illness, and the cure. You don't expect the doctor, you see, to get too caught up in your self-identity and your ethnicity and your family background and your experience as a child and, what your elementary school teacher said to you. And, if you have a broken leg, you want the leg fixed. And you want someone who can focus directly on the problem, not the whole history of your life and what your life means to you. So you can kind of sometimes get to your issues more directly, in some ways in a much more meaningful way, if you can bypass the way we get caught up in self. This is also very interesting to investigate because we take, in the modern West, the personal psychological life for granted. As if this, of course, you'd focus on that for many of us. Not everyone, but many of us. Not realizing to a tremendous degree that our Western cultural view of ourselves comes out of psychoanalysis, comes out of Freud, especially. And before Freud, there was not such a big emphasis on the personal inner experience. Maybe it's fine to do that, but we emphasize the personal inner experience in a way that we didn't do it 200 years ago, 300 years ago. Certain things that were quite public and part of public collective expressions in life and very public things have become more and more internalized, partly because of the influence of psychoanalysis. One of the things that's been internalized to much more than it used to be, or here in the West than it was in the past, or how it is in other cultures, is the expressions of grief. Grief used to be something that was displayed quite publicly. They'd have, you know, public wakes, and people would wail and cry, and it was, you know, people would go around wearing black, and, you know, it was a public thing that you were mourning, and there were a lot of social supports and activities that were expected in the grieving process. And now people still grieve for sure, but it tends, you don't go down the street, and it's not that often you see, you notice anymore, that person's grieving. When I was growing up in Europe, you can kind of tell sometimes, especially the older generation. You say, oh, that woman, she's all dressed in black. Probably her husband died this last year. And you can kind of tell. So the idea that a public display, a public collective involvement, is not something. Religious life used to be a much more public collective event for many people. Still is in some people. And then, you know, in our scene... we tend to, if we err on the private, internal side. You know, we're mindful, go and look at yourself, be yourself, and we'll sit, come in here, we close our eyes, we don't talk. You get to listen to me. And so we kind of, you know, emphasize this kind of internal, more private side in a sense. But in doing that, we hopefully are continuing a Buddhist tradition of meditation practice and inquiry. But we're also somehow going along with a whole movement in our culture, in the Western psychoanalytic culture, to internalize human experience. So I say all this because we take so much for granted and we assume that this is how it is. We're a tradition that emphasizes mindfulness here, but one of the ways of talking about mindfulness is that we're overcoming mindlessness. And because we're often quite mindless of how we think, what we believe, what the assumptions are that drive us, what the feelings are that push us along and affect how we decide to do things. We're mindless about our assumptions, biases, our preconceptions, and we go around, we often miss much of what's going on because of how much we're mindless of. And so one of the tasks of Buddhism is to help us step out of our mindlessness and begin noticing aspects of our life that can help us live a more peaceful life, a freer life, a love that where compassion and joy and happiness can be more part of it. So to get back, so one of the things we can study in the Dharma is study the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha has different perspective often than we have, and it's useful to be challenged by new perspectives. The more someone dislikes Buddhism, the more probably it's interesting to study and challenge and debate and see what's in it for you. But you don't want to study Buddhism too much. It's not so good. And in the beginning it's okay. In the beginning sometimes it's quite okay to be enthusiastic and think this is really, really great because, again, you know, you go study it all. But sooner or later you want to kind of not be too enthusiastic anymore. Because it's kind of a distraction. At some point, studying, being enthusiastic about Buddhism is a distraction because instead of studying yourself, studying your experience, you're studying those books, those darn books, and getting more and more ideas that fill in your head. A couple of times in my life as a Buddhist teacher, I've had the appropriate occasion to answer the question to someone. They asked me, what should I study? What book should I read? And I pointed to them in their chest and said, the book in your heart, that's the one. And because sooner or later, you have to kind of, like, you know, your enthusiasm. One Buddhist teacher, Katagiri Roshi, said, if it's not boring, it's not Buddhism. And another teacher said that Buddhism begins when you become disillusioned with it. And I don't know about disillusioned exactly. It's so depressing. You know, you invested a few years in Buddhist practice and then you're told you're supposed to get disillusioned. I mean, thanks a lot. But the idea being, you know, if you certainly disillusioned in the sense that you have all these illusions about Buddhism. People put so much, they have so much illusion about what it can do for them and who they're going to be and all the different things that sometimes they don't actually do the work of investigation. Of looking more carefully, what is their actual experience for themselves? Some Buddhists will actually read a lot of books about Buddhism and then try to mold themselves to the ideas. try to fit themselves into these ideas to be a good Buddhist. And sometimes that tendency comes out of their own kind of maybe non-Buddhist religious background, where there were tenets of the religion you're supposed to believe. There's a creed. And you know, only if you were only a true religious follower, if you kind of fit or believed or that creed. And so people assume that that's the same thing in Buddhism. And at least I don't think that's the case. I think in Buddhism you're not expected to mold yourself into something so much as use the tools, the perspectives, the teachings of Buddhism as a way to probe and investigate and discover more carefully what's going on here in this life. So at some point, the investigation goes from investigating the Dharma as in books and teachings to applying the investigation to one's immediate experience, to really discover here what's going on here. And that's the beginning of becoming mindful instead of becoming mindless. Many people are relatively mindless about what's going on in the present moment. There's not really a careful attention to what's going on here. Some people spend a lot of time lost in their thought, a lot of times projecting and planning in the future, a lot of times remembering, a lot of time in fantasy. And to be really present here and in a clear and crisp way, where this present moment gets illuminated, is not something a lot of people go through their daily life really experiencing. If you were, you would probably feel that the present moment is vibrant, luminous, because the attention is so clear and so powerful. So we begin to investigate, like, let's pay attention more to what's happening here in this life here. And there's a lot going on in this life here. So you can certainly pay attention to what you do at work, and pay attention to the road as you drive. You can pay attention to the storekeepers as you shop. Pay attention to your friends. You can pay attention to many different things. And it's all worthwhile to live a more heightened, alive life. But in Buddhism, the word dharma, to investigate the Dharma, can also mean investigate the qualities of your mind. Dharma can mean the inner qualities, the activities of your mind and heart itself. And so one of the primary places we probe is in ourselves. What's going on for us? Not to turn away from the world, but because a big part of what the world is our contribution to it, at least for our subjective world that we live in. And so we don't just encounter the world in and of itself as it is. We encounter it through the filter of our subjective views, opinions, history, feelings, ideas that we kind of bring along with us when we meet something. So what is it that we contribute? How are we? What goes on inside of us when we encounter the world? What are our feelings? What are our reactions? What goes on inside? So this is very helpful because it can, for many people, can shift the focus away from a focus that maybe is not so helpful. So, for example, anger often has a focus on someone else, on something, and the object of what we're angry with. And people can be consumed with that anger. And so, you know, that person did me wrong. That's only half of what's going on for you. For you, there's the person you're angry with, the events that happen, but also there's you being an angry person. And so part of the investigation of dharmas is to investigate what's going on here with me. And if you turn your attention 180 degrees from the object of your anger to understand, to look at what's happening here with me when I'm angry, it changes the ecosystem. The whole ecology changes. The whole game changes. It's a hard thing to do because the compulsion and the self-righteousness and the attachment to stay focused on the blame, on the anger, can be so strong that it could take a while even to be convinced that it's useful or safe to turn the attention and notice your half of the picture, your path of what's happening. So he said, what's going on here when I'm angry? What am I feeling? What am I believing? What's happening here? So you might feel hurt, You might feel afraid. You might just feel really hot and irritated. There's a lot of aversion going on. Then you can investigate more carefully. When I'm angry, when I'm hurt, when I'm afraid, how do I hold that? How do I relate to that? Because it doesn't just exist, you know, free-floating anger. It's very, very often. Occasionally, anger can feel free-floating. But it's often deeply entangled with so many other aspects of ourselves. So one of the things that you can see if you look at your anger is you can see, perhaps, that you're afraid of your anger, or you love your anger, or you're clinging to your anger, or there's a lot of hope in your anger, or there's a lot of expectation that you can change things by being angry, or get what you want if you're angry, or you can look back and see that the anger has long history in your life. It's a learned anger. You've learned from your family growing up that the way to respond to things is by being angry. Who knows? But you turn around, you can look more carefully. What is going on here for me? And then you can start teasing apart, and the anger no longer becomes so solid, and probably it's not something that will hold you in its grip. It breaks up a little bit, and you loosen up around it. You kind of begin stepping back from it. And that's part of the function of investigation, is to step back rather than being in the fray. Step back and look more carefully. Not to be aloof or distant, but to step back so you can turn around and look at it and see it more clearly. It's hard to see things clearly if you're caught in the middle of it. So to investigate the Dharma here, to investigate what's going on in ourselves, is a very important aspect of Buddhism. It's particularly important because the primary function of Buddhism is to change the inner landscape, that subjective side of how we react and respond to the world, so that our inner landscape can become peaceful, can become settled. You're not going to find a safe, abiding peace by getting everyone else to behave. It doesn't work for very long. And so if you spend all your time trying to, you know, clean everything up around you, fixing the world, chances are you'll never get around to doing the real work inside that can provide some kind of lasting peace. So part of the task in Buddhism is to investigate. What's going on here? And in investigating yourself this way, Buddhist teachings are not telling you so much what you should be experiencing, but rather what to pay attention to, how to pay attention. How to pay attention and what to pay attention to. So I'll give you another example. Could happen here, maybe it's happened to some of you. You're sitting, meditating quite peacefully, quite happily here at IMC. Mind has finally gotten still. Wow, it took a long time. And then someone walks into the hall in the middle of the meditation, into the front door there, and slams the door and rustles their Velcro jacket, tosses their shoes across the floor into the shoe rack. They kind of miss, and they clank down onto the floor, and then they stomp to a chair, and then they're huffing and puffing. And you are so peaceful and calm. So one option you have is to get indignant, self-righteous. You can get, you know, caught up in that person. The mind can kind of focus, and you can kind of get tight and tense and hot and agitated, and, you know, and of course you're justified in doing that because of that person. And, you know, that shouldn't, and how you're feeling and your agitation and your, that shouldn't be questioned. I mean, that just, that, isn't that like the most natural thing in the world? I mean, that's like your God-given right, is to be steaming given what happened. And then, and of course, there's nothing wrong with you. And it's just that person. Or IMC. I'm going to write to the teacher of IMC and tell them how they have to lock the door at 7:30 and, you know, or do something, because this is not acceptable. So that's, you know, that's all, that you have that option, you know. But it's probably not going to help you to do the deep inner work that's going to find this peace. So there's another approach, the investigation approach. And that would be to stop focusing on the noise and the person, and or to focus on them just enough to realize, thank you. Thank you. You just gave me a lot to work with. This is good. This is what I'm here to do, is to look more carefully and see what goes on with me. And the fact that I was peaceful before gives me a really good vantage point to see more clearly what goes on. So now, so you can even invite, you know, good, let me look at this now. So then you would look and see, what is the nature of that self-righteousness, or that indignation, or that anger, or that sense of hurt? Maybe you discover that you have a really strong attachment to being a good meditator. You want to be the best meditator on your block. And here you were almost going to prove it to yourself because you're finally quiet and still in your mind. And now this person has ruined your chance to get, you know, the best meditator on the block badge that we should probably give out. And, you know, we can have stripes and badges and medals. And so, you know, your identity perhaps has been threatened or challenged to being a good meditator. Or perhaps your life has been difficult lately. And it's so meaningful to have some peace. It feels like so nourishing and satisfying and finally be able to relax your tension. And so there's this deep, deep disappointment that goes on when that's somehow you get stirred up. And so it's understandable maybe you get stirred up and agitated because by you lost something that was meaningful. But it's not necessary to get spin out and get caught by it. So you can go back and turn around and look, what's happened to me there? What's going on for me here? That's, I would say, for people involved in Buddhist practice, a much more mature and useful way of investigating than continuing to investigate who at IMC to write a letter to. Or how are you going to talk to this person after the sitting? You know, what should you say? I'm a Buddhist, I'm going to talk to this person in a very kind way afterwards. Did you notice? And I mean, that's maybe useful to do, but the investigation is to look, what's my contribution? What had happened here? What's going on for me? So this is also very interesting, for example, in meditation itself. It's very common practice in meditation would be to focus on your breath. Mind wanders off, you come back and focus on your breath. And some people find that it's hard to do that because the mind wanders off a lot. And so then they try to come back to the breath again. The mind wanders off in thought and concerns. After 5 minutes to notice that, they come back to the breath. And it seems for some people that it can go on for days and months, and the mind spinning out and thinking a lot. The minds can be very, very active. And it seems like, you know, the mind just keeps being active and just you get more and more frustrated because you keep trying to be with the breath. You think that's what the practice is. So the investigation approach would be, at some point you notice that you're very distractible, get easily distracted. And so then what you do is you investigate your distractibility. You investigate that agitated mind, that agitated thinking. You would turn away, you'd stop paying attention to the breath and stop treating your distractions or your agitation or your thinking as a distraction, and rather you take it as the very thing to be investigated, to be looked at. So what's going on here for me when I keep spinning out this way? One thing you might notice is that there might be a lot of emotions connected to how you're thinking. One thing is that might be a lot of tension in your body somewhere. There might be certain beliefs connected to that are fueling or keeping you hooked to what you're thinking. And so it's possible to go and look and notice, what is it actually going on when I'm thinking, when I'm agitated, when I'm distracted? One of the beautiful things about this is that if you focus on how you're distracted, you're no longer distracted. Because then you're actually looking directly at what's going on for you. And that's a completely valid way of being mindful, is to investigate that. Some people can spend a long time avoiding really looking at what's happening in their mind because they think they're supposed to be on their breath all the time. But breath is useful in meditation, but sometimes you turn and look what's going on. Also, how we look is important. So we can investigate, how am I being mindful? So you might notice that, you know, if you say you're back at your breath, and you say, well, it's one thing to stay with the breath. It's another thing to investigate the qualities of mind that come to bear, that I use to focus on the breath. There's the sledgehammer approach to mindfulness, which you kind of just, you know, take the mind, you pound on the breath. There's the, the ostrich approach to mindfulness, where you barely come out of your little, you know, head out of the sand to kind of just peek and look at the breath and pull back, go away. There's very hesitant. There is striving and pushing and straining. I've got to do this. There's desperation approach. This is so important. I've got to save me this somehow. There's the reluctant, you know. There's the doubtful, you know, I don't think this is going to work. I can't do this. So every breath, you know, this is not going to work. There's all these attitudes that come into play. It's not just simply paying attention, but that we have a relationship to it. There can be a lot of greed. There can be a lot of expectation. There can be a lot of ego and pride and conceit that comes into play. And so one of the things that we do with investigation is we turn around and look, and how am I? What am I doing? What's the quality of my attention? How am I approaching this whole thing to begin with? So, for example, when you turn your attention away from the breath to look at your distracted mind, the earlier example I gave, there also it's interesting to notice, what is my relationship to looking at my distracted mind? Some people have a very adversarial relationship to the thinking world. And the very attempt to look at it, investigate it, comes along with this kind of criticism and probing, and you're like, this is a bad, I'm a bad person, and I'm going to deal with it. It's useful to see that clearly. I have an adversarial relationship. Or there could be a lot of attachment or expectation there. So what I'm trying to convey to you is that one of the things investigation involves in Buddhism is to turn around and look at your subjective experience, to look at your reactions, your responses, your attitudes, to look at what goes on in the mind and the heart as you involve with the world. This is particularly useful when you're being reactive to the world around you. Because when you're being reactive, at least in our definition of being reactive, you're not a free person anymore. You've lost your freedom when you're reactive. And if you want to become a free person again, you need to turn around and look at your reactivity enough to become wise and independent of it, free of it enough, so then you can respond with freedom rather than being pushed around by your compulsions. So this investigation, to look more deeply. I don't think, maybe one of you can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think at this point so far I've told you any particular thing that you're supposed to believe, except that it's useful to investigate. like it's not a creed or a teaching, like this is what Buddhism teaches and thou shalt believe this, and this is what the truth is. This is what the true, you know, true aspect of reality is. But rather the emphasis is discover for yourself what's here. As you do this process of discovery, what are some of the important things you can discover for yourself? You can discover how you make yourself miserable and how you don't. You can understand what you do in your mind which is not helpful and not useful, and what you do in your mind which is helpful and not useful. And being able to see that for yourself then gives you more choice. And I think most people, given the choice, would do the things that are helpful for themselves rather than the things that are not helpful. It can give you a silly example, which when I used to live in San Francisco and came down to Stanford, I noticed I would drive down pretty regularly to go to Stanford, and I noticed pretty quickly that if I drove 101, it had certain consequences for my mental state. And if I drove 280, it had a different consequence for my mental state. And even though it took a little bit longer for me to drive 280, I preferred the mental consequences. It was much more relaxing to go 280. I've noticed, I've noticed there was a time, a long time ago now, that I used to watch football games on television. And there were I certainly enjoyed some of it a little bit, to watch the games. But I also noticed that if I paid attention to my subjective experience, I usually felt, for me, kind of drained and lethargic after watching it. I didn't actually feel very good. I felt kind of off. And so I lost interest because of that feeling. I've noticed that if I rush around a lot, I might get more done, but I feel worse. I've noticed that if I spend a lot of time being anxious, that's not so helpful for me. But if I stop and turn around and look at my anxiousness and breathe and relax and hold it in a kind way, that I feel a lot better. It's helpful to do that. So as we kind of do this investigation, one of the things that will become clear and clearer over time is what is helpful, what is beneficial, and what is not. And no one has to tell you. Buddhism gives you absolutely no obligation to choose one over the other. Buddhism requires, if you want to put your hand on the hot stove, the Buddha didn't say that thou shalt not do that. But when you start seeing clearly the consequence and you see the difference, I think it's kind of a natural thing to choose what's helpful and not helpful. As people develop their investigative powers and see more clearly, especially through meditation, which with time can allow us to see with greater clarity, greater depth, and to see into the possibility of greater, deeper capacities for peace, for calmness, for equanimity, for love, for compassion, for joy, that the reference point for what we can do that brings us peace and what doesn't becomes more and more meaningful. We see more and more deeply what is it that's to our best interest. I'm not telling you what's to your best interest, but I think the investigation will show you that if you keep looking and get settled and calm and deeper. So much so that as the mind gets more and more settled and peaceful, it sees that it's more useful to become more peaceful, more steady. You start seeing that there are times when it's helpful and beneficial not to spend so much time thinking. So much time seeing our life through the filter of concepts and ideas. And you see, and then it becomes interesting. What happens if I drop those concepts and ideas? What if I drop my discursive thinking and become quiet and see the world not through my thinking, but see it in a more direct way, kind of a non-discursive way? And then you might notice at some point that the very way that you operating, there's a sense of self-operating, a certain kind of conceit or a certain kind of self-referencing going on. And if you pay careful attention and feel that self-referencing sense of being the observer, even the sense of being the observer who's watching, the watcher, you see that, it's not really necessary to posit or have the sense of there being a watcher. It's a little bit agitated. Maybe it's not so beneficial. Maybe it would be helpful to let go of the sense of there being a watcher. And so you're willing to let go of it. You notice you don't die. You can still be alive and see clearly without positing that there's a watcher, an observer. There's observation, but there's no idea there's someone who's doing the watching. And this is quite satisfying. This is actually very meaningful. It's deeply meaningful. It's actually more meaningful than a lot of other things you can be doing with your mind, with your life. And so you find that you gravitate towards some deeper and deeper, stiller and stiller place where a lot of the usual boundaries, limitations, concepts of our life begins falling away. And we start seeing other possibilities, other ways of relating, other perspectives of understanding the life that we pick up when we come out of meditation. We have to pick up our life again. We pick up concepts, ideas, self, and all those things. But now we see that it's a construct. We see that it's something we can hold lightly. We don't have to be wedded to it and hooked to it and attached to it and dependent on it. We can use these things when it's useful, and we cannot use it when it's not useful. And if you have the ability to pick up what's useful when it's useful and put it down when it's no longer useful, then you're free. But if you don't have that ability, then you're not free. And if you're not free, the chances are that you're going to suffer. Because kind of in Buddhism, at least, the definition of suffering is it's the result of compulsion. And compulsion is the opposite of freedom. So we investigate. And then there's other kinds of Buddhist teachings that support investigation. And one of them is the usefulness of becoming calm or equanimous. The usefulness of being kind. The usefulness of not being judgmental. The usefulness of being accepting. So when we look at our reactivity, look at our inner life, look at our subjective life, to train ourselves or to gravitate or to lean ourselves towards, incline ourselves towards seeing what's in the inner life in a kind, accepting way. Not judgmentally, not pushing it away, not fixing it, not being in a hurry, but taking a lot of time, just seeing what's there. As if your primary task is to listen, just listen to a good friend who just needs a good person to hear them out. Just listen to yourself deeply. That kind of just being present for the inner life. So the word I wanted to teach you was ehi pasiko. And it's what
did you say?
The word I wanted you to learn was ehi pasiko. Ehi pasiko. E H I P A S I K O. Ehi pasiko. And it's usually translated as come and see. But as an attribute of the Dharma, sometimes it's translated as the Dharma invites inspection. And so I hope that you find that investigating your life is interesting, liberating, and at times playful thing to do. Thank you.